Good afternoon, ladies. Radio. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Jeff Dunphy hosting today as Bosco is away tending to some important business. This is Gold Radio Cafe, and it's hosted by Central Metals Corp. If I sound a bit under the weather, I have been, and on occasion you may get some radio silence. However, let us trust that we can bear through as things undertake. Let's first get you up to speed on the price of gold and silver. At the moment, gold is trading at about $1,716 U.S. Silver is trading at $33.06. The Dow is trading just a smidge under 13,000. And the S&P is trading a little over 1,400 at 1,411. Now, in keeping with our expose on things, I have a lovely litany of things that I want to chat about, and also some questions that we're going to deal with from our brilliant and participative listener, Vinny. Now, before we move on to the questions, I want to address the Dow and the S&P and any other indices that we've seen in terms of them telling us what it means. The Dow Jones Industrial Index, the S&P, the Standard & Poor's 500 effectively, is an indices of what the stock prices of various companies are. And the Dow Jones has a certain number of companies and the S&P has 500. And this lends us to the premise that they are indicative of something. And I want to point out a couple of things that's very relevant to when you hear these indices and whether you can see them for what they are, as opposed to what the intelligentsia, if you will, would like to for you. Now, the first issue is these indices are reported in nominal terms, not real. And as we have said over and over on the show, the real value of the U.S. dollar, we're talking mostly in U.S. dollar terms, however, it is not lost on most of you that the real value of most currencies, certainly the fiat currency system, has fallen dramatically. With the instigation and the issuance of the Federal Reserve Act in 1913, the U.S. dollar at that time, $100 today buys what $1 did in 1913. So that's about 100 years ago. So there's been a massive devaluation of the U.S. currency. And we've seen throughout this time that as the various governments, and now we'll just talk about the U.S. for the moment, but as various governments get themselves into a financial pickle, the economy starts to shrink. They are forced to, or rather they choose to, because it's the only manner in which they can deal with things, print money. And by printing money, they devalue the currency. So when we hear about the Dow Jones being at 13,000, for want of a few points, and the S&P being at 1411, we hear and see that these are in nominal terms, not real. So as the printing presses roll, these indices are a false indicator of the health of the economy. And consequently, as a result, they are not indicative of where the economy is going. Now, that being said, just to Vinny's question, and he wanted to chat a little about the general economic scenario in the EU, and with Spain selling banks and the fiscal cutbacks and the economic realities. Let's chat a little about the pickle that everybody is in at this instant in time. We have economies that are generating revenue. Let's review the U.S. economy. The U.S. economy generates about $2.5 trillion of funds a year. It spends about $3.5 trillion. Now, the interesting bit is these are old numbers. The actual numbers today may be shocking. Who knows? Right? And that premise lends us to believe that they're spending $1 trillion more than they are bringing in, which in and of itself is calamitous. You just can't do that. And in fact, if you went to a bank and said, I earn $100,000 a year, but I spend $200,000 a year, they'd say, we're not lending you any money. In fact, you should be going bankrupt. So that in and of itself. Now let's talk about their official debt, and their official debt is $16 trillion. So they're borrowing $1 trillion to spend $3.5 trillion, and they've got $16 trillion in debt. That doesn't sound very good. But the other calamity here is that their off-balance sheet debt is, in fact, $120 trillion. So that gives us great pause. Now let's chat about various other governments in various other formats as they are moving forward. There are two ways to get more money into the account, if you will, and just as you do, when we earn 100 units of money a day, as long as we're only spending 40 or 50 or 60, we have savings. What we've seen and spoken of for weeks, months, is that all of these governments are spending way more than they get, and they need to in order to facilitate being voted back in. The last U.S. presidential election, these two candidates spent $6 billion on being elected, where they didn't even need to have the election, and Obama would have been in, and they would have saved themselves $6 billion. An interesting bit of food for thought, if you will. Now, that being said, the Europeans have introduced fiscal measures, if you will, where they're overspending. They've said, well, you guys, the electorate, we're going to make you pay for our foolish spending habits. And the electorate has said, well, that's just ridiculous. However, that is what's happening. And the Central Bank of Europe, under Mario Draghi, has imposed what some would say draconian measures. Now, in each country, if they're bringing in 100 units of money and they're spending more than 100 units of money, they're going further and further into the red. However, what does tend to happen is when economies collapse is the general money, the general funds flow that rolls through the government coffers drops precipitously. So it's almost like chasing your tail. The money coming in the door slows down to a trickle, and the fiscal restraints you put on have no effect. Because nobody is saving or scrimping or saving because the flow has slowed right down. So we then get into the law of acceleration, literally bringing these circling the drain, if you will, as they fall apart. But now let's chat about Vinny's question here, because I just wanted to preface a little of where we're going with this. Vinny wanted to talk about where the European Union is going, and how they are dealing with these fiscal issues, if you will. Well, nobody's happy, and Italy and Spain is selling off banks right now. Interestingly, it would be interesting to be a fly on the wall of these banks, seeing, well, we want to sell this bank, and here's its balance sheet, and then behind closed doors they'd say, here are the real warts and all of these assets. But the government will guarantee that they don't hurt you too much, which is effectively what has transpired in terms of the entire global meltdown, is that governments have presented themselves as being able to help out, if you will. How would we phrase it? They've sanitized the assets by making them less onerous to take on. This is when Bank of America took on one of the banks, when they were forced to buy one of the banks, and then a year later they were sued because of the bank they were forced to take on of its lending practices. And interesting, the bankers are saying, just a second, you made me buy this bank, and now you're suing me for what that bank did, even though you made me buy it. It's an interesting irony in all of this scenario. So yes, the Europeans, it is still circling the drain. The Europeans are still pissed with all of this, and the real numbers of how much revenue is flowing, because funds flow in an economy, whether it's in the U.S., whether it's in Europe, whether it's in Asia, is incredibly important. And we'll fall back into Asia in a moment, in just a sec. Okay, now Vinny suggested and wanted to chat a little about Japan and its economic woes. Now, for those of you who want to go and Google Japan, we have a country that was arguably the second largest economy on the planet. It's very good at what it did, not particularly innovative, but boy, when it could take great ideas and manufacture and do some brilliant things with it. It is also resourceless It needs to import resources in order for it to produce its goods. It is also a country that is known for being very xenophobic. Well, xenophobic means this. In all of Japan, there are 126 million people, and there are 1 million foreigners. Heck, in Canada, where we live, where Costco and I live, there are 30-some-odd million people in Canadian, and about 20 million of them are not officially Canadians. They are immigrants of one or two or three generations. We live in a country that is very melting pot, if you will. In Japan, that is not the case. So they have a very old population, and they have a population that is very suspicious, or rather reticent to allow into their country in any economic or numeric way, one of 126 million people. So they're very xenophobic, and their population is dropping. They have a negative population growth. So one of Vinny's questions was, what is their gross debt versus their as a percentage of their GDP? And Japan's gross government debt, and this was at least one, possibly 2 years ago, is 2.2 times what they bring in. So to put that in perspective, the U.S. debt is, they're borrowing $1 trillion, they generate $2.5 trillion, they are spending $3.5 trillion. Right? So Japan's gross government debt is 220% of their GDP. This is unsustainable. Again, a bank would not look upon this and say, healthy company, healthy economy, healthy somebody, we're happy to lend to you. There is no other way out of this but for Japan's economy to collapse. And now it's just a function of kicking the can down the road, which is a lovely adage for what effectively they're all continuing to do, pushing the can down the road. So yes, I think the yen, as Vinny had suggested, is doomed. Now, the Canadian percentage of GDP is about, and this again was in 2011, which is about 85% of GDP. But what that doesn't do is take into account the provincial debt. Now, in the state, the states cannot take on debt without federal mandate. So the feds, the Senate and the Congress have to approve the states taking on debt. So, but in Canada, provinces can take on debt. So our healthy balance sheet, if you will, is probably a bit misconstrued because of the provincial debt. And we are now getting into that place where we are borrowing more and more and more. And why is that? Well, less money is coming in the door. So even if we don't increase our spending, when less money is coming in the door, you still have to borrow in order to facilitate what you're doing. Okay? So that, Vinny, I hope, speaks to some of that. Now, I want to touch on a couple of scenarios here, and also a couple of notes for our listeners relative to being self-reliant and being cognizant of what is happening relative to the Americans, but also globally, and what the Americans are doing. Okay. And there's a lovely website called Liberty Blitzkrieg that I'm going to read to you from, which I think may shed some light on stuff that should give us all serious food for thought and should make us a tad worried, if you will. Okay. So I saw this memo. I'm reading now. I saw this memo on the official whitehouse.government website the other day, but I was traveling and never had a chance to post it. I figured it would be too late by now, yet I'm still not seeing it being widely discussed. It implies that the Obama administration may be very worried about the truth getting out about all of their crimes, potentially via leaks from high places. This would come to be via WikiLeaks as well, I suspect. Read it for yourself. The presidential mandate transmits the national insider threat policy and minimum standards for executive branch insider threat programs to provide direction and guidance to promote the development of effective insider threat programs within departments and agencies to detect, deter, and mitigate actions by employees who may represent a threat to national security. Ho, ho. When the lights get turned on, they don't want to be caught with the proverbial hands in the cookie jar. The resulting insider threat capabilities will strengthen the protection of classified information across the executive branch and reinforce our defenses against adversaries and insiders who misuse their access and endanger our national security. Oh, my. And this came out the day before Thanksgiving. How cute. As someone said on Twitter today, again reading, if telling the truth endangers national security, then we are doing national security wrong. Okay? This gives me great pause, not unlike discovering that the home security bought 450 million hollow point bullets. Okay, now what they're doing is they're starting to say, oh my goodness, if people should actually pay attention to what we're doing, they might take exception to it. That gives me great pause. It gives me great sadness, but it also gives me great pause. There's an old adage saying that the government works for the people, and what we have seen over time, and certainly what Bosco and I have talked about for some time now, is that the government isn't necessarily in it for you and I. They may be in it merely to protect their own interests and to maintain and remain in power. And as we spoke some time ago about the extractive or proactive, if I will, function of a government, we have a government that's diligently trying to extract as much wealth from the system before it collapses, right? And that, you know, I will read this again as I did the other day. Hold on for a second while I cough. What separates successful states from failed ones is whether their governing institutions are inclusive or extractive. Extractive states are controlled by ruling elites whose objective is to extract as much wealth as they can from the rest of society. Inclusive states give everyone access to economic opportunity, and often greater inclusiveness creates more prosperity, which gives an incentive for ever greater inclusiveness. This is color me optimistic and color me utopian is the ideal, if you will, where everybody participates and embraces the economy to the benefit of all. And what we have seen, certainly in terms of the wealth concentration over the last little bit, is the wealth differentiation, the money that you and I have in order to fulfill our living, has over time become increasingly concentrated in the richer of the people. And we will see, and we have seen over time, we've seen great critics of these things, and the powers that be, if you will, those who control the media and control the newspapers and get you to think what they want you to think, say, oh yeah, it's all these conspiracy theorists. Well, if you print money forever, both as Jim Sinclair said and as Bob has previously said on this program, Costco, you devalue the currency, and the consequence gives us great comfort. It scares us on one hand, but it also gives us great comfort that owning gold and silver is of great import to us and our families in terms of preservation of wealth. And I think that's a very important aspect relative to where we go and how we next play and how this thing unfolds. Now let's get further into the global situation and the global issues about how the powers that be may fall into reacting relative to the economies. So all these guys are getting together and they're all chatting. The Palestinians have just been given a modest bump up in recognition in the UN, much to the chagrin of Canada and the U.S. and Israel. They aren't so much a member as they are, they've just been given, they've had their status, if you will, upgraded. However, this again creates more unrest, disorder, and disruption in the ever-going volatility, if you will, of the Middle East. Now, we in America and we in North America have been that our our embrace of it has waned merely because it has lessened our sensitivity to it. However, there is a certain aspect of what has unfolded militarily and economically in the Middle East, not necessarily Israel and Syria right now, which are rattling swords and creating some nasty stuff, and the Palestinians. What's happening and what has been posted in the New York Times over the last little bit has been the Iranian threat, if you will, and the military buildup of the Americans having a whole bunch of warships in the area. We've seen, if I'm not mistaken, an enormous, insidious, and almost hidden in plain view takeover of many of the Middle East states by government, U.S., or U.N., if we will, controlled entities where the Middle East and the petroleum interests are coming further and further under control by the U.S. Now, as a currency disappears, just as we saw in the Weimar Republic, a great way to deal with the fact that you're printing worthless paper is to start a war. And it's not lost on many. It's very easy to find this on Google. It's not lost on many that the way that the Americans, and certainly the way that the Europeans, may be able to get themselves out of this fiscal fiat printing of currency is to start a war. Now what they need to do is they need to couch it, they need to present it in a manner where everybody says it's justified. So this is the place where people's emotions get mucked with, people's verification gets mucked with, and people's emotional nature gets charged up where they say, to hell with things, let's go after them, those bad guys. Whoever the bad guys are, it doesn't matter whether it's Christians or Muslims or Jews or Mohammedans, or it doesn't matter. The guys that are purple or green or yellow or orange or brown or white, it doesn't matter. It's one group getting upset with the other, which certainly flies in the face of you can't do harm to another without hurting yourself, which is an old adage that everybody's known. Is a war imminent? I don't know. Are all the warning signs right there, hidden in plain view? Yes, they are. And this, again, gives me great pause. It makes me sad to know and to think that those who participate in the thinking about our well-being, to which we are a bit delusory, if you will, thinking that the governments are looking out for our best interests. This has generally not been the case for some time, and this is why both Bosco and I always propose and propagate the thought that it's vital for you to be self-reliant in dealing with all of this information. Let it not be lost on us that we, Bosco and I, in presenting this stuff, wish merely to turn on the lights. It's not our place to impose, but it certainly is our place to put in front of you, our listeners, food for thought, and to go and investigate, go and understand that there's a lot of stuff going on that we need to pay particular attention to. And as the illusionists, if you will, in the world the media and people who want you to pay attention to certain things would lull you into a false sense of security, I suspect that is not in your best interests to fall into the hypnosis that the media would have you fall into. There's a cartoon I ran across with a guy on a couch who was saying to his psychiatrist, "I think I'm losing touch with reality TV." Well, let's pay attention to that, as it may be germane in as we wander through and investigate what we're in the throat. Second, another coughing thing is coming up. My apologies. Now, something came up in Canada, which is not of inconsequence, but I wanted to discuss today, and it was the RBC, which used to be called the Royal Bank of Canada, but now has been rebranded as RBC because they wanted to expand globally. The U.S. banks have, in the last 6 or 7 or 8 years, consolidated something. Oh, there's a bit of Hold on for a second. There's some. The U.S. banks, in their consolidation, have gone from dozens and dozens and dozens to literally there's four or five or six large U.S. banks, and there's four or five or six large global banks as well. So that the control of this wealth is becoming more and more and more under the direction of fewer and fewer people. But the Royal Bank, the RBC, posted income of $7.5 billion. And everybody just yawned over it because it was in keeping with what they suggested. Well, that's the largest earnings, the largest net income by any bank in Canada's history. Again, not inconsequential. Now, I want to put that in perspective in terms of the productivity, which Bosco has on many occasions talked about people who roll their sleeves up and produce things. Now, this is a bit skeptical, if you will, and certainly a bit cynical. However, it is in keeping with my history as being in the banking and the investment banking business for most of my career, and that is this. One of the things that transpired over the course of my career was a never-ending knowing that what I did in the system was not necessarily productive, it was extractive. I would be an intermediary, just as banks are. And the bank, the Royal Bank, just made $7.5 billion by being an intermediary, by borrowing and lending money, by capital market playing. And as Bosco and I have chatted about, we think that the capital markets now and so compromised that they are no longer fair or transparent. So now let's put in perspective. In the 70s, the financial institutions, which made up a certain portion, their earnings made up a certain portion of the S&P 500 or the indices of the day, to the tune of, I believe these numbers are between 7 and 9%. Well, recently, of late, the earnings part of the financial institutions in the various indices makes up between 30 and 40%. So now we have, from one perspective, we have a banking system that is not contributory to the economy. They don't make anything. They merely stand in the middle and extract a fee. They're generating 30 to 40% of the earnings of the institutions that are driving the economy. They're merely paper trading. They're merely charging you money on money. They're merely charging you fees. And, you know, we all know what fees are in a checking account. We all know what fees are because they keep rolling in. They are charging you money to have your money, which is a bit ironic. I suspect that there may be a day, we would trust, coming that that isn't necessarily the case. So when we have the earnings of institutions that don't make widgets, gadgets, technologies contributive to the global economy, where the intermediaries are making money, and this is also indicative of how it becomes extractive. Now they're literally vampirizing, if you will. They're just bleeding off the economy. And as the economy gets weaker and weaker and weaker, they look for different ways to bleed off the economy. Now the Royal Bank, it generated $1.6 billion in capital market activities. Now, much of that, I suspect, is in trading in a marketplace that they have vested interest in gaming. Again, we are skeptical, and again, this may be a bit of a skewed perspective, but when you know how to game the system, which Jim Sinclair came out, and Jim Sinclair's website is on this website that we have. When Jim Sinclair comes out and tells everybody how the system is gamed and how they play the system, it's time for us to pay attention. The extraction of the wealth from the system continues, and it gets bled dry, if you will. We need to be mindful of that. That's another yet in a long list of reasons why owning gold and silver is incredibly important. And so let us not lose sight of, as we turn the lights on, you can see things in plain, clear view. Let's not lose sight. The transparency in our capacity to look at things and see what is, as opposed to looking at things and see what we are told to see. Very important. Can you see what is? Or are you seeing what you want to see? Or are you seeing what people are telling you you should see? And with that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to bid you adieu. Thank you very much. I hope, Vinny, that we answered your questions. And I hope if any of you have questions, please feel free to email us at any point in time. And you know how to get a hold of Bosco. And my email address is is viatao@gmail.com. And Bosco's website, and his company is called Central Metals Corp, and his website is goldcoinscanada.blogspot.ca, and his email is mail@centralmetalscorp.com. Trusting again, ladies and gentlemen, that this has been insightful and we've turned the lights on a bit and given you perspective. We do at times skew our perspective, if you will, and we trust that you appreciate our offerings, and we thank you very much for allowing us to be of service. Look forward to speaking with you again next week. Thank you very much.